Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today on episode 224, I have the pleasure of being joined by my colleague and friend, Dr. Royce Chen. Dr. Chen is assistant professor of ophthalmology at Columbia Medical Center, where he also serves as the residency program director. We cover several topics, including surviving as a citizen physician in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic, residency issues such as how residents have been employed, the impact on residency education and surgery numbers, and then we talk a little bit about how we think this will impact the match and things going forward for residents and trainees, both in New York and throughout the country as we move forward into the summer, into the fall. Remember, a list of financial disclosures can be found in the episode description. You can qualify for CME credits and apply for these credits on the American Academy of Ophthalmology website, and there's a link in the episode description to complete that. We have pretty frequent episodes right now. We recorded this episode on April 2nd, 2020. We have new episodes coming out approximately twice a week right now. We have some of these that we recorded before. Some of these were more recent, like this one. We're releasing them more closer to the time of the pandemic to be more topical. So bear with us, and I'll try to keep reminders in the intro of when these were recorded to give you some perspective so you don't wonder why we talk about certain things or not about certain things in episodes. And finally, first plug, Vit Buccal Society annual meeting was canceled this year. As part of the academic committee, I'm super excited to announce that we will be translating the meeting into an interactive online mini-series. These will be carried out via webinars monthly starting in April, and we'll have a series of four webinars, which will include many of the talks, debates, and topics from the Vit Buccal Society. These are designed to be super interactive, very similar to the meeting. The first one will be Monday, April 20th, 8:30 p.m. Eastern. There will be information forthcoming with links to register. Registration is free. Again, registration is free. This is our way of giving back to the community. We want us to hear from you and have you participate. Our first webinar will include Royce himself will actually talk a little bit about COVID-19. We'll also have talks regarding the business impact of COVID-19 on retina practices. We'll have discussions of subretinal surgery and pneumatic retinopexy tips. First-time presentation of medical results. First-time VBS have been the forum for a first-time presentation of a medical retinal trial. And we also have great debate as typical. We're going to have a great, great interactive debate. And this will be the first, again, of a mini-series. So look out for the information. We'll send it out. And without further ado, here's Dr. Royce Chen. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by Dr. Royce Chen. Dr. Chen is an assistant professor of ophthalmology at Columbia Medical Center, where he serves also as the residency program director for the ophthalmology residency. Royce, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me in these momentous times.
Yes, we are recording this. I've started timestamping all these podcasts because things change so quickly. Today's April 2nd, 2020. We're recording this in the afternoon in case something crazy happens in the next 4 hours. It's been a couple of really crazy weeks. It feels like the last 2 weeks have lasted like 3-4 months, Royce. You're in New York. You're on ground level, both as a citizen of New York City and as a physician, and then also as a residency program director. So you're wearing multiple hats, plus you have two kids at home and your wife. And you recently had, I hope you don't mind me saying this, you recently had symptoms of COVID-19. So just give us kind of your perspective on the last 2 weeks. I mean, for some of us, it feels like it's lasted 2 months. It may have felt even longer for you.
Yeah, I got to say, like, the last few weeks for us have really felt like several months, as you're saying, with each day feeling like another week passing by. And it's been pretty intense for the last couple of weeks. The first, at the beginning of March, what we were really doing was kind of gearing up and preparing all of our ophthalmology protocols and figuring out how to prepare for the onslaught, really. And we were nervously eyeing what was happening in Italy and China, and then also trying to figure out how much the spread was going on throughout the city. And of course, the testing was fairly limited then, so it was pretty hard to figure out how many cases were floating around. But I remember before New York City got its first case, I think there were multiple other cities, like maybe Florida or Maryland or something, that got a case before New York. And we're like, well, is this really true? It must be happening in New York pretty soon. And then suddenly there was a large onslaught. Yeah, it's been crazy. And yes, as you mentioned, I did have COVID positive. I had COVID symptoms, ended up getting tested and ended up having a mild positive case. So that was a really interesting kind of experience to go through too, both to understand what symptoms could look like, because I think even though we read the reports out of China and from other places, as humans, we don't really kind of relate to the data as personally as when you experience it yourself or you see a friend that you know that has it. So I thought it was really important that I figured out what a mild case could look like and then could transmit that to my faculty and department and residents.
So, and that you talked about that, you kind of live shelter at home out of necessity, but one of the things, New York was kind of the first example of a place where people were told to be socially distant and maybe weren't as compliant as they should have been at the beginning. And, you know, now we're at a situation where people are doing it, but there's a huge burden of cases, especially in some of the boroughs like Queens. Let's talk a little bit about, first of all, your adjustment just as a member of your family. You have two kids. Juno's your oldest, who she should be in school, mm-hmm. but she's not now. Schools are closed in the New York area. Tell us about balancing that as well as your workload, because I'm sure you've been in many, many meetings as an administrator as well.
Right. So as you know, that I've been in quarantine until recently. So now I'm back at work. But you know, the weeks were probably busier than they've ever been because we were scrambling so much to put all of these protocols into place. and so it's a little bit insane to do all of those things and then also have children be around that are constantly demanding things. There's certainly a huge guilt component to all of that when you are choosing between trying to read to them and then also versus having them sit in front of a screen all day. My wife works for the New York Times and she's been pretty busy as well too, trying to keep up with all of that news. And you know, there's certainly a lot of news happening right now. I think one lesson that we learned is that we have to be a little bit careful with the parental controls with the iPad, because at the end of the day last night, after Juno spent several hours on the iPad, my wife found about $100 worth of apps purchased
wow.
and the receipts going to her email. So we had a little talk with Juno about that yesterday.
These are the things you don't anticipate happening until you're under quarantine, which none of us have lived through before. Let's talk a little bit. You know, one of the most common things, New York has almost become an area of fascination and rumor for people, medical providers, populace around the country, but especially medical providers and ophthalmologists around the country. In a weird way, you would think there would be less rumors because we're more connected than ever with texting and phone calls and news coverage, social media. If anything, you would think we'd have more accurate information. But in a way, we get incomplete bits that kind of feed this panic and frenzy in the rest of the country about what's really going on in New York. And we saw the same thing with stuff that came out of China, Iran, and then Italy. And now it's translated to New York
Absolutely.
As well. What's it been like living in New York City? You've been on quarantine, obviously, but you are on ground zero for news coverage. Your wife was, you know, at home with you as well. You've been in communication with your residents, I'm sure, who've needed support. What's it just been like living in the city?
You know, it's a strange disconnect because you look outside and everything is beautiful. And it's like a nice spring day outside. But then you're living in home quarantine under completely artificial and weird conditions where there's a heightened level of anxiety and you're checking COVID like news or kind of developing protocols against this every day. But I will say that, like, in the midst of this, I feel like the most important thing is actually having steady leadership and accurate information being produced every day. And I'm very grateful that our hospital and many around the city are doing kind of daily briefings to actually provide and disseminate information about what's going on the ground, how many cases are involved, what our capacities are, what are our current situation with masks and PPE, because that, of course, has been changing on a daily to every few days basis as well. And the policies coming out from the CDC have also been continually changing and updated as reflected or in keeping up with the policies and supplies that are present in the U.S. as well. So, you know, on one hand, it's wonderful to spend so much time with my kids and see them, but, you know, there are a lot of different kind of complex psychology is happening here. The guilt, the annoyance, the surprise that iPads could be used to spend so much money on apps, but also it's so great to be with them at the end of a long day too, and to be kind of refreshed by them and their silliness.
So as residency program director, again, one of the things people have heard around the country is, oh, they're putting ophthalmologists on the front lines, residents are being pulled to the front lines. What's been kind of the evolution of how your ophthalmology residents and others in the city have been employed?
Right. So I guess about 3 weeks ago, or maybe it's even 3 to 4 weeks ago now, we started to think about how to minimize risk. Knowing that every single resident or doctor could be a potential spreader of disease or potentially exposed to something that seemed to be extremely contagious, with a higher morbidity rate than flu, right? So I think one of the good things that we did early on, and this was over 2 weeks ago now, was that the New York City program directors got together to talk and share kind of what's going on at each person's institution and share ideas about strategies that each program was doing to kind of protect their residents and, protect our patients. So a few weeks ago, the first things that we did was break every residency group down into teams and really shut down all the kind of unnecessary or not truly emergent patient visits. So at this point in time, we have decreased patient visits by like more than 90%. And our other goals that we had were to basically keep hospital paths away from clinic paths, knowing that the hospitals are really a hotspot for COVID transmission. So we wanted to keep the resident that's going in and out of the hospital for consult away from the patient that's only in the clinic. And then we were trying to do this on as small a scale as possible to handle the patient loads and then rotate the residents around accordingly based on a schedule. So that was the first step of it. And initializing those protocols and then figuring out telemedicine to handle some of the middle responsibilities and the ways that you could see patients or still connect with patients that needed to be checked on was a necessary secondary step. So that was a big thing that we started building pretty quickly as well. And then, of course, there's education. And so, these are residents that are still trainees, and the world doesn't end and residency doesn't end just because this pandemic is looming. So we quickly tried to figure out ways to deliver education to residents. And I've been hearing this happening all over the country at this point in time. But another great thing that happened out of our New York City residency program director meetings is that we had the idea to, now that everybody's doing teleconferencing and anybody can join, we just shared all of our lectures with each other. And that's really created a good feeling of camaraderie and togetherness among the different New York City programs. And that's also provided with the residents with like a very high number of educational opportunities that is even higher than it was before COVID was occurring.
Yeah, I mean, there's some silver linings maybe into this situation from an educational standpoint, like you referenced there. And you did a great job. I mean, you've been sending out, I know, the protocols to program directors around the country for what you guys have been doing. Dr. Getty here shared it with us, what you had shared here. And I think that there's, like you said, there's different challenges. I think a lot of the didactic things can be replaced and maybe even enhanced with some sort of Zoom or equivalent webinar platform for education. And now we're maybe tearing down walls where programs that were in the same city that maybe didn't correspond for their lectures, you can kind of have all the lectures be at the same time because everyone kind of had a different schedule and different sort of schedule for what lectures were given when. There's a different question when it comes to ACGME requirements for procedures and things like that. Certain procedures are definitely still going to happen, consultations, urgent procedures, trauma may happen depending on where you're located. Things like cataracts, or which are considered elective procedures unless there's some sort of acuity to it, just aren't going to happen at the same rate. So when you look at graduating residents, starting with your own, just looking nationally, what do you think will be the implications of the crisis? Obviously, this is not as big an implication as all the human things that are going to happen, all the other implications right. happening for the whole country. But when we look at this in 6 months, hopefully things are more normal in the fall. What would be kind of the implications for your third years? And then thinking about also your juniors, what sort of things, gaps you'll have to fill in?
That's a good question. So that is definitely something that all the residency program directors have been talking about. As in our program, fortunately, I think they're seniors are all well above minimums for almost everything, so I'm not terribly worried about their being competent for fellowship and beyond. Maybe there's like one refractive procedure that hasn't been done yet, but I think they'll get by on that. But I know many programs that are kind of maybe backloaded, or their seniors are expected to do a lot of cases in the last like 4 months, and this is now all out the window because of the canceling of all elective surgeries. And it's a big question and it's a big problem. I think the ACGME thus far hasn't said that the minimums are excused. Of course, the minimums are supposed to be there to guide competency for residency graduation. But as far as I understand, the ACGME hasn't like completely relax that right. that requirement at this point in time. So it's certainly something that gives a lot of pause and concern. That said, I'm sure the entire country to a certain extent is going to be affected by this. And like, I think there could be an asterisk over every single program in the country this right. year. So I'm not really sure what they're going to do. And I think it just requires us as program directors to be really good in our ACGME updates and that we do all the time to really explain the details that were the special circumstances that have occurred within our respective geographies and programs so that it becomes very clear to them, you know, the extenuating circumstances that we're all aware of. Now, if we're concerned that a resident hasn't like really achieved enough and that they're really not ready to go out, that's a separate issue. And then, you know, I don't think we've really thought that far ahead yet as to, like, would we extend this person's training? I think that might need to be evaluated on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, and I think that there's other implications. I mean, you're talking about the ACGME requirements. It's really, really, really important to be compliant. Hopefully, mm-hmm. they're all capable at this point of doing cataracts at most programs in the country. You know, this is more of the time to kind of refine those skills. And there's other ways to refine those skills, maybe with surgical videos and training, kind of staying sharp. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a couple interesting implications from this pandemic for ophthalmology training. One of the trends we've seen nationally, mm-hmm. and one thing even we're moving towards here at Bascom, is kind of these integrated prelim years where you take residents who are typically starting their PGY2 year, and now for their PGY1 year, instead of doing a general surgery or general medical year or a transitional year that involves kind of a mix, there's integrated years uh-huh. where they have some ophthalmology at that home institution. And there's been a push saying, well, 3 years of ophthalmology residency isn't enough. Maybe we should have 3.5 years, or, you know, you should be doing 6 months of ophthalmology. And I would guess the counter argument would be a situation like this, obviously a disaster sort of situation, but I feel it's helpful for your residents to have some background working in an ER or an ICU or a medical floor and maybe having that year under their belt. Any thoughts on, you know, we've kind of moved as a field, even here, like I said, at Bascom, we're moving towards that combined year out of necessity in some ways for education.
Yeah.
But any thoughts on maybe we won't, if this had happens in 5 or 6 years and none of our ophthalmology residents have done a full year of medicine, are they going to be less able to handle these situations if they're pulled?
You know, I don't think it's going to be that they're going to be less able to handle these situations. And I mean, to be honest, many of the people that are getting redeployed at this point in time are attendings and people that maybe I even heard like pathologists getting pulled to do like medicine wards at this point in time. So the fact is that everybody getting pulled for this kind of emergency situation is out of their comfort zone to a certain level. The thing that I've continued to hear from my colleagues at other institutions and our own is that the esprit de corps and the kind of welcoming from the medicine departments of the doctors that have been redeployed is really kind of great. So even though everybody feels totally out of their comfort zone, most cases they're being really well supported by the people that they're going, the divisions that they're going into. And something special in this COVID situation that I also heard yesterday that I hadn't really thought about is that there's actually such a uniformity of patients and kind of conditions right now related to COVID, such as, you know, watching oxygenation and renal status and things like that, that the actual tasks required to handle these patients is not quite as complicated as you would think when you think about the situation without actually experiencing it. So, you know, every institution, I think, is preparing to a different way. I don't think that an internship that has 6 more months of medicine rather than 3 months of medicine, or 3 months of ICU rather than 1 month of ICU, would really make so much of a difference in this situation.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I would agree. I think that just like we were talking about cataract surgery, I don't think it's necessarily, there is definitely value to time and experience, but I think it's like many things, you can get 80% of the results with 20% of the time put in. And kind of the extra time you're putting is the time that takes someone hopefully from, you know, average or good to great. And so if that's kind of the touching up part of it. You know, the other thing I've been thinking about, which we won't know the answer until the fall, is what is this going to do for our applicants who are looking for residency spots, right? So like, because I mentor students who are looking at their residency applications, and I'm thinking, you know, I've had a few who want to do research projects and things they can work on from home. We can't do clinical projects or lab projects, but there's things they can work on from home. And I'm just curious, like, are we going to see more applicants because people move away from primary care fields because of fears from coronavirus? We're going to see less because this motivates people to pursue primary care. But also in terms of the competitiveness of applicants, are people going to have these buffed up CVs because they had 3 or 4 months off from med school to just study for step two or write papers? I think the playing field is going to be completely different. Again, this is probably 155th on the list of important implications for ophthalmology from this process. Yeah. But these are just things I think about when I'm thinking about, man, we already have such a hard time differentiating. Like, what is the, I feel like the scale is going to be shifted in a lot of ways. And maybe applicants don't have as many letters from their mentors because they lost 3 or 4 months where they could have spent time working with mentors to really develop those relationships. Or maybe those letters aren't as meaningful. I don't know.
That is definitely also something that we've been thinking about, given that now usually our Columbia Med students do like away rotation, 1 or 2 away rotations. That's all out the window right now. And then even their home rotations are not happening right now. So they're not getting that experience at that point in time. So hopefully when this blows over in the summer, if that actually happens, then at that point in time, they'll just do their home rotations. And I think it's highly unlikely that they'll do an away rotation. And as you mentioned, the research opportunities are obviously scarce because, like at Columbia, at least, and other places in New York, most research operations have been totally shut down to try to preserve PPE and try to reduce risk of travel and things like that. So we're trying to find like case reports and other kinds of ways to engage the students in research right now. But you're right that they're likely going to have less of that stuff on their CV. They don't have the 3 month luxury of doing a research project like they used to before. So fortunately though, I think that most of the country again will be in a similar boat. It'll be more challenging for us, of course, to try to differentiate. At least we still have step one to look at right now until that goes away or the score goes away in a couple of years. But I think as a program director who writes a lot of these letters, I think we'll just be pretty explicit about extenuating circumstances that our students faced in New York, and I think they'll be all right. I have no idea how many applicants we're going to see, whether it'll be more or less or similar, but I kind of suspect that it'll be similar. Maybe it'll be slightly depressed if people really do feel, you know, a calling to go into primary care or internal medicine. It's hard to say.
Yeah, and it'd be really interesting to see then the metrics this year compared to other years. You know, the last thing, and before I'll give you some time to just close out after that, but the last thing, and this might be 166th on the list of most important things to ophthalmologists right now, but would be I just feel badly for residents who are graduating. I mean, this is true for anyone graduating, high school seniors, high school, college students, but residents who are graduating, fellows who are graduating, I feel like graduation is the whole point of graduation. The reason they call it commencement is it's kind of a time to take stock and reflect and be with your family and friends and the mentors who made that journey special and kind of think about how far you've come before you move on to the next step. And this is definitely going to change things. I mean, we don't know yet what June is going to look like. There's high probability that June is not going to allow for large gatherings of people. Like we found creative ways to make these gatherings still special. But I had a friend of mine who was asking me, saying, hey, you know, I have my kid's graduating high school. Like, what do you have any ideas for what we can do? Because they're pretty bummed out. Like, they're not going to have a graduation. Have you thought at all about what you're going to do? Because I know you're very good about organizing events for your residents and really doing retreats and things to bring them together. What are kind of your plans if graduation's canceled to kind of try to maintain that special nature to the event?
I think for here, if we do it, we could do some kind of virtual event initially. But, you know, I think although they're kind of being deprived of these normal things right now, it's such a strange moment in time, and it's such a strange moment in history. And we will all feel so bonded to each other for the rest of our lives as a result of going through this together, that I think it will actually probably be one of the most memorable experiences of our lives, and it will have happened together. So we'll have some kind of virtual ceremony if that occurs, where maybe we'll honor people, and I'm sure everybody will sign on. Zoom will get even more money, you know, for all the different graduations that are happening virtually. But I think when the time comes that we can start touching each other again and being together, we'll figure out a way, maybe at Academy or at one of our alumni gatherings, to really do a graduation together in person.
Royce, any final words for our listeners? Again, we've had a lot of people tuning into their episodes related to COVID-19. Close to 2,000 ophthalmologists and other providers listening. I think everyone's eager to kind of get perspectives and hear. Anything you want to share with the rest of the country and the world who's listening about the situation in New York? Again, as a medical provider, as a citizen, and as an ophthalmologist and someone in charge of trainees right now?
Yeah. I would say that obviously the basic things like social distancing and all that kind of stuff is critical. It really matters. It's the only thing that society has to actually deal with it. I think for people that are not hit yet, just expect that you're going to be hit. Expect that the symptoms are mild and it can be asymptomatic, so don't trust any person in terms of the risk. So really put up max precautions that you can. But in regard to dealing with this, I think there's a massive psychological burden that we're all facing, and that needs to really be supported by everybody in their respective institutions. And I think the critical thing through this is finding new ways to connect with each other, which has been occurring pretty inspiringly among our groups and our colleagues in New York City. So I think it should just be replicated and is being replicated across the country. And I think if we can figure out ways to kind of reinvent during this period, then we should. Something that I read recently was that during the bubonic plague, Isaac Newton developed his theories on the laws of gravity. So I think a lot of great can come during this time as well. So, yeah, I think those are my thoughts.
Thanks so much. And then as a last plug, and I plugged this in the intro for this, VitBuckle Society annual meeting was canceled this year. We're going to be doing a mini-series for the 8th annual meeting. And first episode will feature Royce talking about many of the issues he's faced at COVID-19 as an ophthalmologist, provider, and educator in New York. So I'm looking forward to that, Royce, and hopefully a lot of our listeners here will check that out, and we'll put information up on our website and social media. Royce, thanks so much. Thank you. Great to hear that you're better, buddy, and stay healthy, stay safe, and hopefully we get to see each other in person soon.
Thanks a lot, Jay.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. You can find all 224 episodes, including this one. They're sorted by category. We have a lot more free time in our hands with the pandemic. If you're looking to refresh or just kind of stay sharp with the community, or you're just looking for retina topics, some of these episodes I've gone back and listened to are terrific. They're sorted by category and great, great searching function on the website. You can find us also in the Apple Store and Android Store. That's how I access the most recent episodes as they come out. If you go to the website, there's a mailing list you can sign up for that will give you emails every time a new episode comes out. We're on Facebook and on Twitter, and you can also find our episodes co-hosted on the American Academy of Ophthalmology website, as well as the American Society of Retina Specialists website. As we move forward, episode ideas, again, are so critical. So if you have ideas for episodes, please reach out. We're happy to talk about different subjects, especially in this very tumultuous time. Thank you again to Dr. Royce Chen for joining me. Thanks to Mike Minacasa, Angela Chang, and Louis Kai, who are the doctors and residents who are working really, really hard on the front lines, but also put together this episode and the accompanying social media. Providers everywhere, thank you for what you're doing. No matter what you're doing, whether you're seeing patients on a reduced basis, whether you're seeing emergency and urgent patients, whether you have been pulled to the front lines, you're helping out our colleagues and the other subspecialties, whatever you're doing, or just maybe being socially distant, everything you're doing to help the cause and help the world and the country get through this pandemic, we really, really appreciate it. Most recent episodes have ended with a quote. I'm going to end with a quote from Shakespeare. I stole this. I will give credits to Dr. Julia Haller, who put the St. Crispin's Day speech in a recent email to the Wills community. This is from Henry V, Act 4, Scene 3, and the end of the speech. And St. Crispin, Crispian, shall never go by from this day to the ending of the world. But we in it shall be remembered, we few, we happy few, we band of brothers. For he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother, be he never so vile. This day shall gentle his condition. And gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap while any speaks that they fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day. Good luck, and stay safe.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.